critical value or your cutoff value, the point that indicates where you should reject and where you should accept H0, depending on which side you fall.
And then, so that would, like, assuming that these are the right numbers,
right.
That would be compared. The number that I get, and I would compare that to the value on the chart.
Right.
And exactly. The value on the chart is smaller or larger?
Well, it depends on what your H1 and H0 look like. You need to set up your hypotheses. So there's really some good, you know, there's some good practice to start identifying and doing with each problem. All right? Set up H0 and H1 and write that down. Even if it's in the text already, you know, telling you to test these hypotheses, write it out so you visually see it each time. So you identify, in particular, H1, which tells you what direction, because that direction will tell you whether you reject it, if it's small, large, or what way you go. Okay?
Do you have a little piece of tape?
Mm-hmm. So, and setting up H0 and H1. In this example, 411, you're trying to see there is a significant difference in the effectiveness. When you hear the phrase, is there a difference or not, you're not looking for A being better than B or B being better than A, you're just looking for a difference. So if the differences are all about zero on average, there's really no difference between the two methods. If the difference on average is not zero, then you say there is a significant difference. So I'm looking for a two-sided test. Okay.
So any difference, as long as it doesn't turn out to be the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what you're going to be doing then is you're going to see the differences were, what, 5, negative 1, 2. There's some negatives, some positives, and you're trying to say whether they on average are about 0 or whether on average they are different from 0. Okay, and you're going to check that with some significance level. Okay, so you want to set up hypotheses, and H1 is the one that will gear what your region looks like.
When is it appropriate to use a t-test in writing?
Well, you have a couple different t-tests. All the t-tests so far, though, are really geared at what type of assumption, that your sample sizes are small. Mm-hmm. You do the z-test versions, where we have them, if your sample sizes are large, because really what you're doing is falling off that t-table and going to the z-percentiles anyway. You're basically doing it as if it's a normal distribution overall.
Okay, when is a good point to decide whether it's large or small?
What was the cutoff we mentioned?
30
observations. It's a rule of thumb the book uses, and so that's the rule of thumb we all use too. You guys can pull up a tabletop. You can sit on the floor over here. Maybe we can move this case, possibly. Is that all right? Just so it's out of the way, we can get more people here.
I have a question about 4.9, just a small part of it. I did the whole problem and figured out D bar and S sub D, but that I think is where I had the problem. I think I got 81 for that. And
you should have a whole range of values that you square here. This is that's a sum. That means you're going to, right.
But the sum of DI is 30. I added all those.
No, it's not the sum of DI. It's the sum of these differences squared across each difference. So you do it for each difference. You take 2 minus 3 squared. 8 minus 3 squared.
Oh, I see.
10 minus 3. Negative 8 minus 3. And square all those.
That's so long.
Yeah, it is long. But you have is this yours?
Yeah.
You have the ability to do it right in there.
I know.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
And if you can, you know, all it means is entering these differences in a list.
Okay.
And doing your one variable summary measures.
Okay.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And get it that way.
Okay.
And in general, that number is either going to be calculated or it will be so easy that the differences work out very nicely. What calculator do you need? Okay, 85 I'm not as familiar with overall. What I might want to suggest is maybe at the end of the session I can show you a couple things. Okay?
As far as 4.9, for the 98% confidence interval,
right?
Without an alpha?
You have an alpha.
We do?
What's 98% giving you, really?
Oh, true. We already have.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
Right.
I wanted to ask about
2.5?
Yeah, the answer in the book I've not really gotten. I want to make sure.
Answer in the book is not guaranteed to be right. That many questions that they're doing answers for, you may get some wrong. 2.5 is doing the test on the previous exercise data, that there is a higher mean response for treatment 1. And these are definitely large sample sizes, 79 and 62. So what did we do for our your test statistic in particular? Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah.
We are looking for a direction here. It's going to be a z-statistic. What did you get for your z-statistic value?
I got -2.94.
I have -2.22. But
that's what it's really about.
No, that maybe that's all they typed up then.
It's -2.22 because that's what I said.
Yep, okay. So you might need to check whether you plugged in your sample variances correctly or your sample standard deviations.
Is it the top?
What'd you get for the numerator?
For the numerator, I got -19.
Correct.
And then for the bottom, I got 6.47.
That should be about 8.5.
Okay.
So check the calculation in the bottom.
Mm-hmm. I have a question on those. Like, it doesn't matter what order you put when it says, like, the different groups, like, the X.
This
and why you have to which ones you have to minus, like which
in general, if it has a 1 and a 2 label to it, we'll call 1 group 1 and call that X bar.
Okay.
And 2 group 2 and call it Y bar, just for consistency purposes. But you just need to know, and it really truly doesn't matter which way you do it, because if you did your confidence interval switching them around, instead of getting a confidence interval going from 2 to 8, you've got it going from -8 to -2.
So that doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
You make the same decision. It's just to keep in mind which direction then you're going, if it's a direction you're headed. If you're trying to say one's better than the other, then you should have certain types of numbers, positive or negative. So it truly does not matter. But if it is set up, you know, the X data is this, here's group one, then keep it. Mm-hmm.
For 2.23, I really don't think there's an alpha for that one.
No, are you sure about that?
I don't know. No, I'm not so sure, but
okay.
There really isn't.
Do you just assume 0.05?
Well, there's a couple of ways to go. Do the assumptions and test. True, they don't give you an alpha. What do you get, though? Let's see what the result is. What do you get overall for your test statistic? 2.23.
I didn't do it because I didn't know.
Okay.
-2.57.
Okay, -2.57 is good. Mm-hmm. -2.57 is your test statistic.
Mm-hmm.
You want to still find the p-values you normally would, and then 0.05 is a good rule of thumb to use in general. What I would do, though, is check the answer with both 1, 5, and 10%, all three. Because then you might say, well, if I make the decision that's the same for all three of those, then I pretty much know what my decision should be. Okay? If your p-value turns out to be so small that you'd reject for all those levels, then go ahead and say so. If it's in between, for some alphas you'd reject, for some you wouldn't, then say, you know, for alpha 0.05, we would reject H0. However, if alpha were 1%, we would not quite reject H0. And then you're reporting the results, you're telling me you know how to do the test if alpha were given.
Mm-hmm.
In an exam, we generally will give you the specified alpha, because in any clinical study or anything, there is a determined alpha that is set ahead of time, so you will have that.
I see the answer for 4.9.
Okay. These I have not checked, so I'm just looking them over, and I'll be checking them over in general. 4.9 is
yeah.
A confidence interval?
Yeah, for SD, I got 2.75.
Nope. SD, I have 5.8. Now, again, I don't have them checked these myself. 5.8 also. Okay. Did you enter them in L1? Try entering these numbers into L1. Do you know how to do that on
yeah.
your calculator? All right, we need a little calculator session at the end of time today, okay? Because it is nice and easy to do it that way.
Okay. Do I square each one separately? 2
yep.
minus 3 squared
yep.
plus 8 minus 3 squared.
Yep. And your degree, you get 10 observations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And then square root of
that. Yep, that is the right approach, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that maybe minusing a negative, you did something wrong. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, good.
I don't know how to do this. Like, I'm 2.13.
Okay, that's the one that's a little different. I mentioned it in lecture a little bit. Most of the time our hypotheses in this chapter, chapter 10, are looking for a hypothesis value being 0, right? Because you're looking for whether the two are equivalent or that you're not, and maybe they're not in a certain way. Here's one where they actually wanted you to test something that wasn't 0, but it's still the easiest thing to do. All right? You made your confidence interval in part A? What did you get for a confidence interval in part A?
10.28,
13.64. Okay. 10 to about 13.5, right? All right. There's a range of what I would consider plausible potential values for mu1 minus mu2. Right? Values that I think are likely to be mu1 minus mu2 at a 95% confidence level. And what they're asking for is for you to test the hypotheses. Just looking at that, does it indicate to you there that it might be 10 as a possible value, just as, to get a feel for what the answer might be?
Yeah.
Is 10 reasonable? Does it look at 10, the value 10?
Yeah.
Is 10 inside that interval?
Yeah.
Take a look.
No. Well, yeah, it's 10.28. Oh, 10. Oh, yeah.
That's all right. It's okay. All right. 10 is not a reasonable value according to the interval, right?
Okay.
Okay. So we probably are going to what? End up rejecting or accepting? What do we think? Probably rejecting. All it requires us to is to adjust our test statistic a little bit. You're going to calculate, or you already have calculated, x bar and y bar. But you want to now see whether that difference in the sample means is significantly different from 10. Okay? Significantly higher than 10. So you're going to subtract off 10 instead of subtracting off 0. And then still divide by that standard error. That's your test statistic now. And you do the test the same way you would with any other two observed test statistics. Each degrees of freedom will be the 13 degrees of freedom. And so you just adjust what you subtract off as the hypothesized value.
So to just say that because 10 is not in the 99% confidence interval, that's not enough to say that.
Not quite, yeah. I wanted to look at our interval just to get a feel. The thing is, there's two things that are not quite right here to be able to do that and be our answer alone. That is that the confidence interval you made was 95%, and they want you to do the test at a 1%. So those are different right there. And your Part B test is not a two-sided test. Your H1, your alternative, is trying to say whether mu1 minus mu2 is more than 10. So you're looking for a direction, and you can't test a confidence interval. Confidence intervals are two-sided. There are such things as one-sided confidence intervals, but we don't go through those in this class anyway. So you really do need to perform the test. The test is performed, though, by just adjusting your test statistic and subtracting off 10 when you compute it, and then still doing it as a t-test that is upper-tailed with an alpha level of 0.01.
For that t1, you would have to have the standard deviation divided by n minus 1. That one?
The standard deviations will always have an n minus 1 in them, but you are given the standard deviations already computed for you. Take a look at page 420.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to do anything with n minus 1 as far as calculating because the s's are given to you.
So you just square them and add?
So yeah, you want to do the same thing for how you do a t-test here. You have to get your sp, and then have 1 over n1 plus 1 over n2. So you have to get SP from your two S's for that formula for combining the two.
The SP would be the S1 minus S2?
Nope, SP has the formula. And it's a pretty complicated one, but it's about averaging or pooling. I'm going to take a look at page.
You have to take a square?
You have to square each of them. You weight them by the degrees of freedom. The formula's on the top of page 450 for the actual formula for finding your pooled weighted average estimate. Page 450. Yeah. That's your formula. And you know what, I really, as I mentioned in lecture, pull out your formula sheet. Start working with your homework with the formula sheet. Then you don't have to flip pages. You've got it right next to you. And you start really feeling comfortable with the way the formulas are presented there for your exam for next week. All the formulas are there. You're not going to have to memorize any formulas. All we don't do is we don't put a scenario in there and calculate the T for you and then write out the conclusion and everything. So that's why you should understand the process, but then the ability to use the formulas that are provided.
And so this one at the top S is your SP, and then you've got to multiply that by the square root of
1 over N1.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the small sample T, two sample T test, two independent samples. The only adjustment we had to do in 213 is that we had to subtract off the 10 instead of really subtracting off just 10. Because we were looking for a difference of 10 or more. Mm-hmm.
I just want to ask, I'm still confused between independent and paired.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, for 219,
mm-hmm.
it gives us, it says that they did a comparative study on measurements of aerobic capacities, and they recorded for a group of 20 natives, whatever, and 10 U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we, like, differentiate?
Well, there's a couple giveaways that will tell you what to do without even thinking hardly at all, right? Basically, every study is trying to compare two groups. And yes, they're trying to make the groups somewhat comparable, with the exception of a difference in, you know, one aspect and seeing whether that aspect is significant or not. The thing is, did they directly match and pair one-to-one, one from this group and one from this group, and put them together, or are they really just two separate groups? When your sample sizes, which are here 10 and 20, 20 Peruvian natives and 10 U.S. subjects, you can't have pairing. There's no way you could have paired 20 over here with 10 over here. So there's a group of 10 and an independent group of 20 that I'm comparing overall. Okay. Versus, even if your sample size is the same, for example, 2.23 on page 423 is about 6 rats that received a growth hormone and 6 control rats. They're 6 and 6. Could there be pairing there? Not because of the way they gave you the summary data. The only way you can do a paired design, a paired t-test, would be that you have the ability to either calculate the differences or you have the differences to work from. So you can get D bar and you can get the standard deviation for the differences. When you just have not the 6 observations for each group, but the summary of X bar, Y bar, 2 standard deviations, you can't get differences from there. You can't get SD from there. You couldn't do it as a paired test with this setup. And these are the two classic ways of giving data. Summarizing by giving the mean and standard deviation already for you, or in the case when it is paired, as in section 4, setting it up so you have person or pair or household or farm number 1, and there are the two responses for it. They almost add another row to tell you what pairing number it is. They make them link together. If you have data laid out and you say, look at those first 2, is there something they have in common? Do they have to go together? They both came from person number 1. They have to be compared to each other. They have to be a paired observation. Versus if I had 10 people here and 10 people here in 2 different teaching methods, that first person over here doesn't have to necessarily be paired up with this first person over here. They just were 2 separate groups taught with 2 different methods that I'm comparing as a whole, overall. I didn't match them by gender or by pretest score or anything else. I'm looking at the 2 test scores for the 2 teaching methods overall. But a lot of times the way the data is presented should indicate the idea, along with a description, of course, of the problem. Okay? If the sample sizes are not equal, it can't be paired. If all you have are just 2 means and 2 standard deviations for these 2 groups, whether they're the same sample size or not, it can't be paired. You can't analyze it as a paired situation. If you have the actual data, as in even 2.21, and it's listed out there, and they look like they're the same number of observations, it doesn't guarantee it's going to be paired. We have to still take a look at the description.
So in that example, that would be independent.
Yep. Basically, they said 20 workers were included in the experiment. Of these, 10 were selected at random and trained with method 1. The remaining 10 were trained with method 2.
Okay.
That at random means that those 2 groups are independent.
So that's how you can kind of pick them out. If they're both laid out like that, you can pick it out because it'll always specify that at random if it's not paired.
That's how independence assumption is usually met, by saying that I took the people and randomly allocated them into 2 groups. Okay? That's typically how it's done. Or at least I went to this population of U.S. citizens and pick a sample at random of 20. And I went to this population of Peruvian people and picked 10 at random, though they're still supposed to be independent samples. Okay, that's how you distinguish between the 2.
On 2.23, they ask for an explanation, like in a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
How would you want it? What were you looking for?
2.23?
Yeah.
Do a test. State the assumptions. So, I mean, there's...
And the assumptions.
The assumptions. The assumptions are going to be usually in the summary also. The 2 basic components of all tests so far is that you've got random sample or samples, and you've got normal distributions, or you've got the large sample sizes, so you get the normality. But those are all the ideas, but you still need to be able to say them correctly. Rather, you can't just say, what are the assumptions? Random sample, normal, you know, that's not enough. You have to tell me what's a random sample. What's normally distributed? What are you talking about there? So you need to be able to say it in a sentence. All right? In terms of the actual assumptions, section 4, page 431, paired design. There's assumptions right in that blue box. So maybe when you're practicing for the exam and you have your form of sheet to study from, maybe you write that out next to that on the form of sheet. So every time you go to that to look at and do, you remember that assumption with it. but you have small sample inferences about the mean difference. Assume that the differences are a random sample from a normal distribution. That's what you have as an underlying assumption for the paired t-test for the confidence interval. Every confidence interval, along with its test, that they're hand in hand, have the same assumptions underlying them.
What's assumption again?
Assumption is, what does the data have to be in order for this inference procedure to work? You know, we talk about this 95% confident, and we say that means if you were to repeat it over and over, 95% of these intervals are going to contain the right quantity. Well, that only works if you really are taking random samples and you have normality to begin with, because you're, what are you doing in your, you're using a t-distribution, which comes from the fact that that's what you should get when you sample from normal curves, t-curves for the test statistic. So those assumptions are there to some degree. There's a little robustness.
For normal curve, normal distribution, you just say 0, it was 0, 1.
No, it is actually normal with some mean difference and some standard deviation, but you don't even have to write that notation. You can just say from a normal distribution, and that's adequate. It's not, your differences and your data is not going to come from a normal 0, 1. That mean all your observations have to be around 0. No, they come from some normal distribution that might be 0, 1.
So the confidence interval, again, what you said was, if you're doing it over and over again, say it's 95%, 95% of the time, this will be included in the interval? Or
not the interval. Don't interpret your confidence interval level with just one interval. You should interpret it as being looking at many intervals. It's wrong to say 95% of the time the mean mu will be in this interval. That is not correct, because mu is either in that one interval or it's not.
Mm-hmm.
95% of the intervals made with this method, if it were repeated, are expected to contain mu. I'm emphasizing the plural intervals. I can talk about the collection of possible intervals and what I expect for that collection. I can't talk about every one interval, because either it does or doesn't. Okay. They did have a pretty good picture back in Chapter 8 when they first introduced confidence intervals to kind of remind you of that idea. And I knew we kind of sketched the idea of it. It's page 320. Okay, 320. And the example 6 on page 322 are both good ones to maybe recap that idea again. But see how every one interval either does contain the parameter or it misses it. You're talking about the collection of intervals if you were to repeat it many times. And we'd expect 95% of them to be yes, to be good ones. The one that I got, I have no idea which one it is. I know which one it matches up to. I don't know whether mu's in it or not. But I know that the procedure is such that 95% of the intervals made with this method in repeated samples are expected to contain mu. That's why I have confidence in the one I have. That's what I can say.
Okay.
All right.
I have sort of a general question. If you have a small, in the matched pair comparisons,
mm-hmm.
if you have a small number, then they give us all the formulas for the t-test.
Right.
If you have a large number, they only give us the
t-formula, right?
Yeah.
You can always do it as a t-test.
Or no, that would be a z.
You can still call it a t-statistic. If your sample size is large, though, you're just going to be farther down in that t-table.
And you're using
z, basically, anyway. So you can call it a z if you wish, but you don't even have to. Keep it a t. Do it with the 60 degrees of freedom, and it really is a t-test.
But
it's so close to the amount of the one that you're basically going to do.
What if you wanted to find the confidence interval, though, for something large?
Well, again, you would basically can use the z alpha over 2 number in there instead of the t one.
So it's all the same formulas.
Yeah, it's the same formulas, though. Just T versus Z. Mm-hmm. If you always do it as a t-test, which is why the way the pair design is presented, doesn't present a Z version of it, really, you will always be correct. It's just that when you get to degrees of freedom on your t-table,
mm-hmm.
where are you going to be? Way down at the bottom, possibly even at the very end,
mm-hmm.
which is your Z percentiles anyway, i.e. you're doing it as a z-test.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So everything's like this is not how it was for the independent.
Right. They gave
okay.
you both
so
versions.
If it's large, we do the t-test only
mm-hmm.
when it comes down to alpha, we're looking it up on the z-table.
Yeah. Or you can look it up on the t-table. The very last column
mm-hmm.
or row with the alpha, infinity degrees of freedom is your z percentiles. That is what that is there. Your computer output doesn't say t versus z. It just does it always as a t-test, no matter what the sample size is. And it has the ability to have actually t-distributions with 100 degrees of freedom or 300 degrees of freedom, because it can do it that way. So it's very precise.
Okay.
Fisher said, if you were doing it by yourself, and it was 300 degrees of freedom, your answer as a z-test wouldn't be hardly any different from their answer calling it a t. Okay, over here.
Yeah, on 2-2.23,
mm-hmm.
I like, set everything up. Like, I set up the t,
mm-hmm.
like, test, did x bar over y bar over square root 2, 1 over n, 1 plus s2 over n2.
This one.
Yep. Do I need to, okay.
Mm-hmm.
What do I compare that to, then?
What's your degrees of freedom here going to be? It's going to be 5 degrees? Okay, which one?
I didn't do
the t-test.
Do you not need to do one, or you just... Well, the other formula.
Right, you want... I'm looking at the solution here, and the solution here has it doing it with that t-star that we did not cover. Why are they doing it with this t-star version?
Right, yeah.
Okay, because look at those two sample standard deviations there, 2.23. 57 and 16, right, are your two sample standard deviations?
Wait.
Is that what you got?
2.23?
You got 60, what did I say? 57 and 16 is what I have written down here. Now, again, I haven't checked these answers. 2.23. Yeah, oh, 7. That's wrong. All right. But anyway, what there are some informal tests that you could say, are these two sample standard deviations comparable enough? The thing is, here, we are not doing the T-star version. We're not going further and going through that, because the degrees of freedom do get to be a little strange, or you take the minimum of the two, and
right.
So on. So you can just treat this as a regular T problem, where we are still going to pool those two. Now, does it say?
Will you like, go through like, and do this one?
It's going to be done just like you have, just like you did 219, or just like you did 220, in terms of what test statistic you should use here. 219 and 220 have the one that we just wrote out a minute ago, too. So I'm going to advocate that you should still take the 41 and the 60 and subtract it, and the denominator should have the 1 over 6 and 1 over 6 with the SP down there. So you want to pool the two S's and get an SP. And use that to get your test statistic, and your degrees of freedom here would be 10 degrees of freedom. 6 plus 6 minus 2.
And then what do you compare that to? Like what like?
And then you're going to go to 10 degrees of freedom for your t distribution and find its p value or find a cutoff value, depending on it's a lower tail test. So I would find its p value and compare that to. Is this one that doesn't have an alpha? It doesn't have the alpha.
If we did it the other way,
yeah, I'm going to make a note to the GSIs, because had I seen that one was assigned, because I didn't assign these questions, I might not have had that in there.
What's the alpha? Like, what do you take in the alpha?
Take an alpha of 0.05 if it's not given, and make your decision that way. That way I know you can make the decision if alpha were given at any particular level, and that would be fine.
When is it appropriate to use S-pooled, and when is it not?
The only two cases we have here is when you have large samples, you don't have to pool, and you do it as a z-test. If your sample sizes are small, then we're going to add the assumption of common population variance and pool and do it as a t-test. Those are the two main roads that we're taking here.
So it should, if it's not a large sample, it always needs to be S-pooled.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then if it is a large population, then it's just the S, the
squared
over N.
Over the N's. Mm-hmm.
So small is pool?
Small
what
is pool.
Do you do? I don't understand really what you're talking about. The pools.
The pooling is just saying, see, if you don't pool and you have small sample sizes, then that t that you're really computing is not going to have exactly a t distribution. Its distribution is not a t distribution, but you can approximate it being conservative, and it goes through this whole technique with this t star, which works, and you can do the test that way. But rather than going through all that subtlety, we have just said let's still assume common variance. Your test is pretty robust against that assumption, meaning even if the variances weren't that real good, you'd still be okay to do it as a t-test. So we're just going to be saying, let's assume that the two variabilities in the two populations are the same for their responses. And so our two S's are both estimating that. We pool them together to get a good estimate overall.
So that's like how we just did 6 plus 6 is 12 minus 2.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For the degrees of freedom.
For 2.23, was the alternative hypothesis. What was the alternative hypothesis?
Can we say that again? 3.1?
The one we just did, 2.23.
Was
it an upper tail?
No, lower-tailed.
Oh.
One-sided lower-tailed. Depends, though, again, what you call control and hormone, group one and group two. Typically, the rule is to use the first one listed there as being group one and the second one being group two. But if you identify it differently, just say so, so that we know how you're calculating your quantities.
Okay.
And you want to say that the weight gain is higher if they receive the hormone, so I'd want the group two to be higher, group one to be lower.
Mm-hmm.
So 1 minus 2 should be low, negative.
Right.
That's why it's a lower child test and thinking that through.
For 4.13,
mm-hmm.
4.13?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit about making your design even a little better by making sure you do some randomization. This is a paired design, right? Because we're pairing up these plots by farm. But even in a paired design, there should be some randomization, perhaps, if it's possible. Especially when you have two items that are paired, and one of them is supposed to get one treatment, and the other is supposed to get the other, but they're going to be compared as a pair. Which of those two items gets which treatment should be randomized. That's the idea. So that you won't always have, you know, if your farm was always set up to have a top plot and a lower plot, a north and a south one, don't always give the north plot strain A and all the south strain B, because you might have that be confounding. That might be something that says the water all drained from north to south, so the south ones didn't do well because of the drainage problem. And then that would, you wouldn't know whether or not strain B didn't do well because of drainage, or whether they didn't do well because of being strain B. So you randomize. So that's the idea we want you to get in there. How can you randomize? Here's farm A, or farm number one. Here are the two plots. Plot one and plot two. Flip a coin. If it's a heads, plot one gets A. If it's a tails, plot two gets A. And that's how you can make the assignment. I'm gonna wait doing it anyway. And there's a couple other questions like that, right? That you have to kind of think through.
Can you tell me the answer for 4.11?
Okay, did you get your standard deviation? What did you get for your SD?
2.61.
That's much better. And what did you get for your T statistic?
4.59.
That's a little better too. Mm-hmm.
So I reject.
And you reject.
Okay.
What did you get for your T statistic?
4.59.
4.5. No.
My D bar was 1.33.
What should be on the bottom here?
Oh, square root of A. Thanks.
Yep.
I was confused about how to do 4.14.
Yeah.
First, I was confused about whether or not it was paired, because they made it seem like.
Right.
It,
if you read the full problem, or actually get to part C, and read that part C also, it tells you that. What they're doing here is they're taking the same data, and it really was paired.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're saying, let's pretend that data came from a situation where it was not paired. So you're not using the information of putting this one with this one and comparing it directly. You're
mm-hmm.
just comparing the two groups completely as a whole, independently. And it turns out that in 4.13, you say you would reject H0. Strain A is significantly higher than strain B.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when you do it as an independent samples design, not using that pairing aspect, you end up accepting H0. If you analyze it with the SP and the T-statistic for independent samples, so you're doing the T-test for independent samples here.
Where should get to be the rejection zone in 4.13?
In 1.3? They have 1.895. Reject if it's more than that. 7 degrees of freedom. Upper 5%. And so the idea here that they're getting at is that the calculations, the data were the same. However, the standard errors get to be different because you didn't use the pairing aspect. You didn't work with differences. The reduction in variability helps to make the pair design better. I've got a bunch of observations over here, and they vary. And here's another bunch of observations, and they vary too. Now, part of the reason why they vary is because they came from different farms. But these came from the same set of farms, so I should put them together so that I compare an apple to an apple and look at that difference due to the treatment alone. the same two plots from the same farm. And I'm using that extra information. So that if this farm, if one farm was unusually high, would probably unusually high for both strain A and strain B. But the difference then, the gain in the difference of those two strains would be maxed coming out correctly. Versus if you just kept them as two independent sets, a very large observation here does not get directly compared with a very large one here. And even though in that you aren't using that aspect, you're not reducing variability due to from farm to farm by pairing them. Reducing variability is usually always good, because that means you're going to be able to compare things more accurately and see if there's a difference or not. So by pairing, you reduced variability from farm to farm by comparing directly, and you're able to see the significant difference in these two strains. Whereas that variability among the farms, not comparing them with pairs, masked out the actual increase in strain A over strain B. And so you didn't see it when you treated it as independent samples. Okay. One of the pros and cons section they mentioned about pairing helps to reduce variability responses because you're comparing one item that's very like to the other. The only difference is the treatment. So you're getting a better idea of what the treatment effect really is. Or is it harder to measure if you've got independent samples because there's other things that are affecting those things?
What's your 2.15
was assigned?
No.
That's
part of it.
2.13 and 2.19.
Alright. How did you, I don't know if you just said this, for 4.13, to set up your null hypothesis and alternate hypothesis. And it's a one-tailed test, but would you still set it up as S equal to 0 and then S greater than 0?
Mm-hmm. That's
you wouldn't do like S minus S1.
That delta, when you're saying S, you mean this delta thing. Right?
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that is really the difference in the means.
Oh.
Okay? The mean of the differences is the difference in the means. What I mean there is, if you had taken and calculated the differences for each farm and averaged those, that's called D-bar.
Right.
That's representing what you think is the mean of the differences.
Mm-hmm.
If you calculated the average of the first group, X-bar, and calculated the average of the second group, Y-bar, those are the means separately, and if you take the difference of those means, you get back D-bar.
Okay.
So this symbol is reserved to represent that we're in a paired situation, and it represents the mean difference.
Okay. So how do you know whether you want to put greater than or less than 0?
Depends on how you calculate your differences. In general, you're going to calculate just going down, A minus B.
Right.
If difference is defined to be A minus B, then the mean of my differences, I generally want to see them being positive to show that A is bigger than B on average. So just think that through.
For 7.23.
For A, you would test it as being independent.
And then,
yeah, I could tell
B. Right. Well, take a look again. You have, they're looking at two different routes. Five drivers were randomly selected from a group of 10 and assigned to route A. And then the other five were given B. So is that way of selecting or assignment going to indicate paired or independent? Independent.
Mm-hmm.
I had 10 altogether. I just randomly picked 5. I didn't take the 10 drivers and kind of analyze their driving habits and try to put two together as a pair to say these guys are both are a little fast on the throttle or whatever. They didn't try to match them. They just picked 5 and sent them to one group. So that's how they're doing it. They're doing it as an independent samples design. Small sample sizes, so we'll have to get SP and calculate the test statistic that way. An alternative design for the study would be, though, to make the comparison more comparable by doing some kind of pairing. How would you compare them? So maybe by driving habits. How many accidents they had that might indicate whether they're a reckless driver or not. And you put them together by whether they're reckless or not reckless. Something like that. Whenever you can make the drivers, that's one way. What would be another way? That would even be better.
You could take the 10 drivers and have each one drive through A and each one drive through B.
Perfect. Exactly. If you have the same person driving both routes, then you have that same characteristics in the driver affecting both answers, and the differences would be due to the routes, perhaps more than just the driver differences. Okay. 2.19 is, you're not calculating a test statistic here, though. You're doing a confidence interval.
And don't you have to calculate the test statistics to get the confidence interval?
No, not, but the confidence interval will be constructed by taking this difference plus or minus a couple of these. And you've got to put your SP on here. So look at, again, start getting your formula sheet out so you can.
Where is that formula sheet?
Do you have your packet from your old exams and the confidence intervals? Oh, excuse me, the computer modules?
Is that in the back of that big packet we have?
The gold packet. Mm-hmm. It is back there. And it's also on the web. If you want to go on there and print it from there, you can.
Okay, it's on the web, and it's just called the...
It's under all the course info, and I think it says formula sheets.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You print out a copy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, for calculators, you have the ability to enter data. Does anyone else have a TI that they maybe want a little more review of at all? Do you have a TI?
82.
You have an 82?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know how to put data in
and
enlist and do all that? Okay. Are you in 100 or not? No, that's where we did it all too. In the 85, you also have ability, and it's all under the stat button. Okay. And under stat, we have calculating things and editing things. So under edit, it says, okay, you're going to edit two possible lists, or just one. All you do is just keep those names and hit enter. And you've already got some data there. Okay. You can enter your listing of your differences and put them in under all the X's. Let's suppose you had your differences, like these. Suppose you wanted to get the average of these five numbers. Okay. So you can type in your 18, your 24, I'm putting them in as X's. I'm putting on a 30.
Are you skipping
the Y's for now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. 21. And then a 32.
How do you skip? Do you just push beyond?
Yeah, just down.
Okay.
Once they're entered, if I go further, I'll see that there's nothing left after that. So I've just got those numbers. Mm-hmm. Then I can go back out. You can go back to calculate. So I'm going to go back to stat, calculate. And they're again the same two names. Those are the ones I'm going to work with. One bar. I push one bar, there's your X bar, and there's your standard deviation.
So good.
Okay. Pretty nice, right?
Yeah.
When you go back to stat, there's insert, sort, there's clear. See the clear X and Y? That's how you want to press to get them all back to nothing, so you can enter data at the start.
Like
mm-hmm. Basically, it's under stat and edit and stat and calc. Mm-hmm. And you guys have it the same, the 82s. You want to go under stat and also do it under edit. So press edit under stat. And you should have a listings there, L1, L2, L3. Mm-hmm. Pick one of those, doesn't matter which one you want to use, and put your numbers in them.
Like just for the X's?
Just for the X's, or if you have two sets, put one in one and one in the other, and you can analyze both of them, but one at a time.
Okay.
So you put in some data. Maybe you want to put in your strain A's or your differences, if you calculated your differences.
I already.
Okay.
What am I trying to find out here?
This is a pair design. If it's a pair design, you can enter your differences.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put those in one of your lists, you can have the list do your X bar and your...
Wait, it's under stat? Okay, here's stat.
Mm-hmm. Then you always have to hit enter to just say, yes, those are the two variable names.
Oh.
Or just down. Yeah, there you go. Now you can enter data.
Then what do you do? If you just fill in
if you fill in your numbers,
mm-hmm.
then you want to go back to stat and go over to calculate and say, I want to calculate some things.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing that you want to do is one bar. So go over to calculate. The F left and right arrows will get you moving back and forth. And there's one variable statistics. And then you specify at the end of that either L1 or whatever column it's in. It'll automatically do it on L1 if you don't tell it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you have to have one bar and then put second function.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make it skip? Like, I can't make it skip.
Just go down.
It doesn't.
Oh, because you cleared out the one already. It always needs to be just a one there to hold the place, but it doesn't have to be a number. That's part of your data. You want to always enter X's.
If I'm doing one list tile, I just enter the X's and,
just,
then,
yep, mm-hmm.
and then I go.
So
Oh, okay.
So,
what
mm-hmm.
is this doing here?
Now, what that says is that you're going to call up to do summary measures.
Mm-hmm.
If you want it on L1, you can just hit enter.
Mm-hmm.
If you want it on L2 or something else, you have to do second function and specify L2 behind it.
Oh.
We can put in L1 just to show you what that looks like, and that's what it should look like, depending on which column you have.
Okay, I'm just
hit enter, and it will give you X bar and give you S right there for you. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to do all that calculation by hand.
Wait, I lost it again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't even know where I am.
Okay. You need to just quit. And quit out and try it again. Okay? Edit. Just go down, down. We've got some numbers in there. Okay, we've got three numbers in so far.
Yeah.
Okay, one more. Once you've entered the last number, go back. You can either just start out again at stack. And then what? Calc. So whenever you get to this screen, because you can give different names to variables and keep them saved. Just go down to with the down arrow key. Mm-hmm. And then you want to specify number one, F1, one variable summary measures, which is calc. Mm-hmm. The one bar. Mm-hmm.
So do you know, like, for your
And again, though, no, we're not. With homework, you have the time to be able to calculate these things.
Mm-hmm.
On an exam, I'm not going to have a list of 20 numbers so that someone who doesn't have the ability to do it with a calculator is going to have to sit there and do all these square things.
Which one is standard
deviation?
You want to use S, because it's always going to be a set of data.
Like SX.
Yes.
Matched pair for these, matched pair. When we have, it says we have 16 different plots, but there's 8 pairs. So we use 8 as the number, right?
Correct. Good. And that's a common error that's done. In pair design, you always have pairings, right? And even though I had 8 farms with 16 plots, 8 is still the number I use as my N. Because you're now really not looking at 16 numbers. You're going to look at 8 differences only. So those are the number of observations you have.
So like how many pairs?
How many pairs is N? Correct. Well, I saw a card out there for the sign right outside my door.
Okay.
You might take a look at that. Otherwise, some people advertise. And if you... my head GSI has some names, and I've been forwarding people who ask about a tutor to her, and she gets them in contact. And
who's your head GSI?
Her name is Rong Zhang, but you can email me, and I'll forward it to her, too.
Oh,
okay.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go home and try and get this done.
Okay,
so
do you have the top one, though, so I can just make a note? Have you let your GSI know at all what happened yet, or not?
I haven't, because I was hoping I would just
get
be able
done.
To get it done.
Mm-hmm.
But I still might. I have a few hours before my next class.
You have a funny story, don't you? Come on, share it with them so they know.
So ridiculous. No. This is so funny. I went to visit my dad in Pennsylvania, which is like a 6-hour drive away. First of all, I'm the biggest nerd anyway because I brought all of my stuff, right? So I had my backpack full with like all the stuff that I need, all of my stat stuff, all the stuff for these tests that I have this week. I get about halfway home, about 3 hours into the drive, and I'm like, oh my God. I left my entire backpack. I left it at my dad's. I'm like, oh my God. So I stopped, I got off an exit. I didn't tell you this part. I got off at an exit, called him from a payphone, and he was laughing at me. He's like, I can't believe you left this here. You must be freaking out. I'm like, mm-hmm. So he airmailed my backpack to me. I got it yesterday afternoon, but like I was already way behind in this and in all my other classes that I have tests in, so whatever.
Listen to my story. I'm still behind.
So
I got
funny.
A stomach infection. I had to go to the emergency room. Like, this was like 3 weeks ago. I'm still trying to catch up. I missed an exam, and I had a paper due, and I got behind in stats. I'm still like behind on my stats, like trying to catch up, but my GSI is really nice. Then I still have to do some makeup.
We're never prepared, are we?
One thing after another.
Mm-hmm. I'll do it to you.
Thank you. I got to go teach 11, but thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have a question.
Yes.
I have to go away this weekend. What should I do? I have to leave tomorrow morning, so what should I do? I'm going on a plane, and I want to do a bunch of practice for stats, so
mm-hmm.
What would you recommend?
Well, I would look at the exam, too, in the back of your book of the packet.
Model.
Exactly. We are going through, tentatively, section 6 of chapter 11.
Do we just use
okay,
this?
In terms of homework.
You
and so
your
I'll be
observed
finishing
value that you got from the
topic on Friday.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look that up in the table.
chapter 11, 1 through 6.
Mm-hmm. It depends on which test you did. If you did the T test, mm-hmm. then you look it up in the T table.
Okay.
The observed value.
Okay, what do I need to simplify? We won't teach.
So X bar is our D bar.
Oops, that, and then that, and then the consent form. Mm-hmm.
So X bar is D bar if they were differences,
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Just
good. We need just really brief personal information for the recording.
For the what?
Oh, we're doing a recording for this.
They were just listening to our language.
Mm-hmm.
And no names, no video, but they're going to be analyzing some language and. I don't even know all the details.
The language for academic English,
mm-hmm.
mostly for teaching non-native speakers.
Okay.
I find it end up being TAs and statistics a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
So if I, for some reason, can't turn it, should I still email her? Or
well, I wrote on the top, but I would email her or let her know anyway, just so it's
right
here. Hi, Jen.
Yes.
Hi, Jen.
And I actually, but I'm doing chapters 3 and 11,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't even have the same chapters that I'm doing.
I'm so I'm not sure you know that. You know, when it says homework 8, it doesn't mean chapters.
Oh, I understand.
Okay.
I looked into the solution, but
it
doesn't have the same chapter.
We can look on my computer, because basically I just have to get into the server from last semester, and I still will not guarantee that all the problems are there. Cause
I think I looked, but I was working here yesterday, but I couldn't. Somehow there's not homework solution 10 in the server.
Okay.
Or 9, I think. I couldn't find the same chapter.
Can
so
I check one answer?
Mm-hmm.
When it's check time to.
I have to go teach it, and I'm already
okay.
I'm never mind.
Can you find me something later? At maybe around between 2:30 and 3.
I'm going to look at
the
back. If you can find it here, or look on a different disk that maybe I have in view. But, you know, I only have what I have. I'm going to pick up some solutions.
Okay.
Okay. Alrighty. I'll leave this here in case you want to come back, but I'll be back between 2 and 3.
Okay.
Okay. Yep.